Good morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Hello. It's 6 past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. This is Air America Radio. My name's Mark Riley. Mark Maron is away this week, but he'll be back next Monday. My very special guest co-host is the same guest co-host we had yesterday. He was so good yesterday, we brought him back for another day. He is best-selling author and World Wrestling Entertainment champion, Mr. Mick Foley. Good morning, Mick.
And you forgot one other important fact. He is tired.
Oh, really? He's tired. I forgot.
How do you guys do this thing, man? You know what it's like to, you know, to set your alarm clock for 3 o'clock in the morning when it's 12:30 a.m. Man, I'm gonna try to be intelligent. That's hard enough for a wrestler with sleep, but we'll see how things go. But I had a great time yesterday, and we're looking forward to it again today.
Well, you know what, we got Mick's wheelhouse coming up today because we're gonna talk about a guy that Mick Foley is quite familiar with. His name is Brett Bozell. He runs the Parents Television Council. And Mick has history with this guy, and there's an article in this week's Time magazine that talks about the inner workings of the PTC, something, again, that Mick Foley knows a heck of a lot about because you kind of smacked him down a little, didn't you?
Yeah, it baffles me as to how this man became one of the most influential people in this country as far as what the entire nation is allowed to see. He carries an enormous amount of influence, and in my opinion, he shouldn't have any. And I will explain a little later why, and he should really have no credibility whatsoever, stemming from his campaign against WWE SmackDown that was a miserable failure and ended up in a court of law.
There you go. Now, later this morning, we're also going to be talking to one of Mick's former teachers. Professors?
It's not just that we grabbed one of my former professors. This is a guy. He's the go-to guy. He is a professor at Syracuse University. Actually, they put in the Center for Television and Popular Culture. Yes. He's the expert. He's a guy that you've probably read quotes from hundreds of times, appeared on dozens of different television shows. He's real witty, real informative, Professor Robert Thompson.
He's going to be joining us, and he says you are the only one of his former students to have his own action figure.
Yeah, but I'm not the only one of his former students with a WWE affiliation. Like, course of time, three of our writers have been Syracuse University grads, and one of them still is there. Brian Gewirtz is still there.
Wow. And also, later this morning, and this is going to be a real treat, not that, you know, because Mick is a professional athlete, it's not that we're going to, you know, turn this into Sports Center or anything. But guess who's going to be on with us later this morning? None other than New York Giants running back Tiki Barber.
Tiki Barber. Tiki and I, we have some history. Good history.
Good history.
Positive history. We're both.
Let's hope so. I don't want him in studio with you guys fighting it out over here, right?
We're both volunteers for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. I see Tiki a couple times a year for the past 5 years. And we were party guests. I might get into that a little bit later. We were both at a very influential person's party and hooked up there.
Oh, wow.
Not in a romantic way, but got together and shared some laughs.
Thanks for clarifying that, Mick. Now, Tiki is actually starring in the off-Broadway production of John Patrick Shanley's Women of Manhattan.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, how are we going to make this politically viable?
What?
The Tiki Barber conversation.
Do we have to?
You just wanted to get a couple of one real athlete, one pseudo athlete talking plays and radio.
And radio. Yeah. I mean, the guy's a thespian. I mean, he may have a career after.
And he had an awesome year. For those of you who don't know, he was a leading rusher in the NFL, broke all kinds of records for the Giants, and a great guy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, Mick, I wanted to ask you, because this is something that's always made me very curious about wrestling. How badly do people really respond to those millions of people who come up to you in airports and on the street and say, wrestling's fake? What do you do?
You know, it used to be. It used to be a lot worse, and that's, you know.
They get beat down.
They don't get beat down. But you know, I had kind of like the conversation stopper because I had the missing ear going for me. And back in those days when I really defended what I did, it'd be like, oh yeah, well, look, do you have both ears? And I can't even wear sunglasses. And which I feel kind of stupid about, because Owen Hart, you know, who was a great guy, and you know, unfortunately passed away in a real bad accident several years ago. He had the best response when people would come up to him and say, "Isn't that all fake?" You go, "Every bit of it." And they, "It is?" And he goes, "Everything." "You sure?" "I've never been hurt. I've been doing this for 15 years." And then you actually get the people who asked you if it was fake defending wrestling. "No, no, no. I remember this one time. I saw The Undertaker throw Mankind off the Hell in a Cell." And so the simplest thing is just to agree with them. But I think since Vince McMahon came out and publicly said that it's entertainment, people are better able to respect what we do as almost like creative artists. And they kind of look past that whole fake real thing.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like over the years they've kind of changed. Just like, and we were talking about this off the air, the evolution of the babyface versus heel paradigm in wrestling, where there was always a very clear-cut good and evil, and now you see that the lines have been blurred. And some people, by the way, get upset about with wrestling about that, the fact that there isn't a clear-cut good and evil, and they, you know, they try and tie it to some level of moral relativism.
As in Brent Bozell?
Well, we're going to get to him. We're going to give him the smackdown before our 3 hours.
You know what's strange, Mark, is in a way, it actually worked for me. Once you know, people were able to better appreciate it something of a pseudo art form, it made me look good. Because I was the guy who was known for taking a beating, and all of a sudden people were like, "Oh, I get it. He's really good at looking really bad." And then they started appreciating it, and it was almost like all the Mick Foley injuries were, you know, badges of honor earned, you know, to help make, you know, make the whole thing look better.
Well, you know, for me, it was like watching some of those early videos. They did a bio on you on some television network. I was surfing one night, and all of a sudden, I see you on top of some house somewhere. And I'm looking at, whoa, wait, hold everything. And I'm saying, you know, this guy has wanted to do this from almost from day one or something.
Danny Zucker's roof.
Yeah, there you go.
Danny Zucker's roof. It was not something that should have been done. Unfortunately, you know, there have been some people out there who thought that that was my gateway to WWE. They didn't realize
that's
that
what was, they made it sound
that
like.
That was 1984, and I got into WWE in 1996, and there was an awful lot of, you know, roads traveled and $10 paydays in between. So that's no route to fame, trust me.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's funny because we had Bruce Weber on yesterday talking about Harley Race's school. And, you know, you wonder, because that article made it sound like those guys really don't have that kind of illusion anymore, that this is their, you know, I mean, yeah, they do. Some of them obviously want to make it to the big time, but some of them seem to be perfectly content to do what they're doing.
Well, when I'm asked for advice, when people ask me for my advice, I try telling them, look, you're getting yourselves involved in a business where the chances for success are really slim and the chances for being hurt seriously while pursuing that slim chance for success are really high. So you have to keep everything in perspective, and you have to try to enjoy the ride along the way, because you can have a heck of a time traveling from town to town, getting to go to a few foreign countries and not make a fortune and not become a household name. And I think if people are better able to, you know, smell the roses and enjoy the experience, they won't come out of it so bitter, because a lot of the top names, you know, have trouble coping. I mean, it's very difficult, especially when you essentially play a superhero and then find out one day that you are not, that you are very human and you are without a job and without the adulation. It's a tough adjustment. Yeah. And it wasn't always easy for me, but I had kind of the book writing thing and avenues and classes I could speak.
You're well-rounded.
To. Yeah, I had it easier than most people do.
You know, it's interesting. We're now going to take a break and pirouette daintily from your wrestling career to the career of the leading neocon death cult figure in America, that being Paul Wolfowitz. We talked a little bit about him yesterday. It looks like his nomination to head the World Bank is pretty much a done deal. We'll get into that. We'll get into the death penalty and some very cynical stuff that's coming out of the West Coast. We got a bunch of show for you, so stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition.
We've got the highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Weather.
19 minutes past the hour of 6 o'clock. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off for the week. He's back next Monday. Our special guest co-host is none other than Mick Foley, best-selling author and wrestling legend. Now, a legend in neoconservative circles is a
nice segue.
Yeah, you like
nice.
That. Well, he seems to be on his way toward being the boss of the World Bank. Paul Wolfowitz, we're talking about. Former, what was it, Assistant Defense Secretary?
Deputy
Secretary. Defense Secretary. Yes, defense, under yes. Donald Rumsfeld. The alleged architect of the Iraq War. I don't know if he still wants to take credit for that. Certainly, he was the architect of many of the more outrageous claims about what the war would do.
You know, when I met Wolfowitz, he actually had a badge on that said deputy, big shiny.
Stop. For real.
No.
Well, he is now going to be the boss. Deputy no more. He has been nominated to be president of the World Bank. And it looks as though German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, who some people thought might lead a European rebellion against Wolfowitz, has now said that he will not stand in the way of the nomination. And that pretty much looks like that's it as far as the opposition, certainly from Europe, is concerned.
Man, you know, I'm this is not a joke. You probably know that I've had dinner at the Pentagon. I've actually been a guest of Paul Wolfowitz. That's a long story. I'd be glad to get into it later on if we have a lot of time. But I've been invited back, and man, I'm going to hand in my resume because you talk about having job security. You can literally do no wrong in that Department of Defense. I can't think of a way that Paul Wolfowitz could have blundered more issues and been the recipient of a huge raise, not only
huge
money,
raise
but
and promotion,
profile. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, ironically enough, some people are saying that Wolfowitz's nomination shows that Bush is at least taking the World Bank and its role seriously. We should say, for the sake of our audience's knowledge, that what happens in the World Bank and its sister institution, the International Monetary Fund, is that the U.S. usually nominates the president of the World Bank, and then Europe nominates the president of the International Monetary Fund. Well, in 2000, America stopped the European nomination to the IMF. That was the route and the precedent that was set that led some people to believe that Europe might revolt against Wolfowitz. Now, they've invited him to Brussels to sit down with the members and representatives of the European Union to explain exactly what his intentions are. There are published reports that say now that a member of the European Commission, which I guess runs the EU, is now saying that Wolfowitz is going to make that trip. He's actually going to go to Brussels. He's going to sit down. He's been on a charm offensive, apparently, since Bush made the nomination.
Listen, I've met Wolfowitz. I don't believe there is any charm.
He called Bono from you too, for God's sake. Why would Paul Wolfowitz call Bono on the phone and say, hey, help me grease the skids here?
Street credibility. I'm not sure. But David Korn yesterday from The Nation accused me of being a terrible optimist because I was trying to look at the bright side, and I was trying to say, is it possible that with a high-profile guy like Wolfowitz entering the World Bank, that maybe a spotlight can be shown on some of these, underdeveloped countries? And could there be a positive to this in that, we may make that more of a priority in this country, which has been horribly lacking?
Well, it's interesting because what you see now is, in terms of people who oppose Wolfowitz, the last possible resistance is going to come from the developing world. The problem is that places like Brazil and places like South Africa haven't coalesced around an alternate candidate to Wolfowitz, so the Europeans don't really have anybody to put forward. And everybody seems to be afraid, if these reports are to be believed, everybody seems to be afraid of incurring America's wrath in opposing Wolfowitz too publicly or for too long a period of time. So it looks like the skids are done and he's going to get the gig.
Well, and like I said, at this point, I can only hope for the best and hope that something positive will come out of it. But I'm baffled as to what his credentials are to be the head of an important organization like that.
Yeah. Well, there have been stories that at the World Bank headquarters, they were passing around clips of John Stewart on The Daily Show skewering Wolfowitz. There are all these different things that are going around about the guy. But he is saying to people, he's saying right now to anybody who will listen, in fact,
that he is not going to, bring a unilateral approach, in other words, a unilateral American approach to the business of the World Bank, that he is in fact going to seek consensus, and that he sees the World Bank's primary mission as trying to alleviate poverty. Now, many developing countries would argue that point about both the World Bank and the IMF in terms of some of the draconian measures that have been recommended in the past to straighten out economies as a condition of getting World Bank loans. And apparently they have about $20 billion a year to play with in terms of dispersing money to different developing countries.
See, Mike Wolfowitz, just to make it a point, being part of the neoconservatives, might they try to do an incredible job and be able to go farther than a more liberal person or a not so conservative person would do, just because they've got the administration who will back it and come away with that Bush's help me out here, what's his
what?
Phrase the
the spread of freedom and democracy,
not just the march of freedom, what was his this has got to be a sleep deprivation thing. His I'm a, what?
Compassionate conservatism. Yeah, that's it.
Couldn't this be seen as compassionate conservatism if Paul Wolfowitz could lead the way to the U.S., showing a little more caring about some of these developing countries that don't have oil underneath their surface?
Sure, it could, but I don't think it will. I think Paul Wolfowitz is running a game on people. I think what he's saying now is not going to be the way he ends up conducting the World Bank. I think he's saying this now because he has to say it now. In order to get confirmed, in order to quell the European opposition, and it appears that he's been successful at that, he's got to say, oh, no, I'm a multilateralist. Oh, no, I'm going to alleviate poverty in the world. One of the things that the World Bank is judged on, and of course, we're not talking about the world, philanthropy organization.
Yes.
The World Bank makes loans like yes. any other bank. So the question, most World Bank presidents are judged by how much of these loans end up getting paid back.
But isn't he trying to make a difference? Isn't he trying to make grants instead of loans in some cases?
In some cases, well, I mean, I don't know if the bank is going to be making grants. I think maybe he may bring that to the table as part of, his way of trying to quell the opposition.
Now, let me just say, for people who think I'm sticking up for him, I'm kind of repulsed.
Yeah, I'm starting to think
I'm kind of repulsed by Wolfowitz. And as I mentioned, I met him. It was one of the strangest things in my life to be face-to-face with him and have somebody say, hey, there's somebody I want you to meet, and I turn around and it's Wolfowitz.
Wow.
And I'd actually sat behind him at a ceremony, for a groundbreaking ceremony for a new amputee wing at Walter Reed, and realized I can't say, hello, Mr. Wolfowitz, it's nice to meet you, but I could say, how are you? I know the troops appreciate your support. But he's eerie. He's skeevy.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, Mick Foley's going to get his wish. He's going to do the Palm Pilot this morning. You ready?
Never been more ready in my life.
Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Are you?
Four past the hour. This is Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off this week. He'll be back next Monday. Our guest co-host, wrestling legend and best-selling author Mick Foley. We've got the latest on the Terri Schiavo case. But first, Mick Foley, you wanted to do the Palm Pilot.
I know. I put up a big enough fuss, right?
And today, you shall do the Palm Pilot. Not that, people are scared of you because you're a legendary professional wrestler or anything.
But this is a big honor. This is Marin's baby, right? I mean, I'm encroaching on Marin territory. I came home and I thought things went really well yesterday.
Yeah, it did.
And
did you get a call from Marin or something?
No. But my mom, she listened to most of the show and she said, you did great. And I said, yeah, I guess so. She said, what's wrong? I said, they wouldn't let me do the Palm Pilot. So it just shows that in radio, even at Air America, the squeaky wheel still gets the oil.
Well, we're liberals.
This is going to be great. I just hope I can do it justice.
Marin, go ahead. Said, you got it.
It's now?
It's all yours.
Oh, I didn't know it was now. Okay. All right. Phew.
Breathe.
All right. And I hope I don't just do a weak Marin rendition.
Go ahead, man. Go ahead.
Taking center stage in the whole Schiavo mess is the terribly shy House Majority Leader Tom the Hammer DeLay. Ramon just stopped by. So here is Tom DeLay's Palm Pilot for today. 6 a.m., wake up. With industrial glue gun, affix hair to scalp. All right, fake laugh, but I'll go for it. I'll take it at this point. 8 a.m., at Starbucks, stand on a stranger's neck until he whimpers for mercy, just for practice. 10 a.m., divert attention from my ethics violations by suing the Hamburglar for infringing on my nickname. Good, good, it's good stuff. 12:30 p.m., use Shivo case to show public my sympathetic side, and if they don't see it, threaten to exterminate them. 3 p.m., blame Democrats for something. You know they've done something today, those weasels. 5 p.m., accuse Michael Shivo of the same things Michael Jackson is accused of. All Michaels are scum. Note, launch preemptive attack against Michael Jordan, Michael Chiklis, Michael Douglas, and George Michael, whose last name is Michael. 10 p.m., seize with hatred until sleep comes.
You did it! Nice job, Nick Foley! That was wonderful, man. You did a good, work.
Oh, whew.
Now,
thank you.
The latest on the Terri Schiavo case. A federal judge has refused to order the reinsertion of Terri Schiavo's feeding tube. This denies an emergency request from the woman's parents, and of course, that was what Congress was up until 12-something in the morning the other day doing. It's what President Bush flew all the way back from Texas to do, was to put this in the federal courts, and the federal courts have said no. This was a ruling by U.S. District Judge James Whitmore. It came, of course, yesterday. He heard the testimony. I believe it was supposed to be a half hour on each side. I think he might have heard a little longer than that. But it was some very, very intense testimony. And as you alluded to, by the way, in the Palm Pilot, this was Tom DeLay's way of diverting attention from alleged ethical lapses, perhaps, to get out front on this.
Yeah, I mean, I give the judge a lot of credit. I don't know what his political affiliations are, but to stand up to the president and deny him, it takes a lot of guts.
Well, let's hope he doesn't get his taxes soon. We're going to talk a little bit about things judicial as well, Mick, because out on the West Coast is a story that is just really making a lot of headlines, making a lot of waves, and it is centered around a former prosecutor's claim that he conspired with a judge who was Jewish. He passed away some years ago, the judge did, to keep Jewish jurors off of one specific death penalty case, and that hearing is going to be, there's a court hearing scheduled on this prosecutor's assertions today, but it has very, very broad implications across the state of California in terms of what this guy is saying was a common practice, and that was to exclude Jews from juries in death penalty
cases.
But
not just Jews. It was black women as well.
Yes.
Okay, black women as well. Now, that's conspiring to keep Jews and black women off of juries. It would be illegal, would it not?
It would be illegal, and what makes it interesting and important now, because there's been stuff on the books that is supposed to stop this a long time ago. Back, I remember when I first started working in radio, umpteen zillion years ago, you talk to lawyers off the record, they would tell you here in New York, we use our peremptory challenges to keep certain people off juries if we're afraid, for example, if it's a situation involving a cop and a cop's credibility, they keep black women off the jury because the presumption is that black people don't trust the cops because there's been a contentious relationship over time.
And did the judge also go on record as saying that part of the reason was because, you know, no Jew would send somebody to the gas chamber?
Yeah, that is an alleged claim on the part of this guy, John Jack Quatman.
Okay, that's what the prosecutor says. I don't believe that's on the record. So if it is illegal and it has been done, then what would there be a penalty involved? Because conceivably people have been sentenced to death and have died that might otherwise be alive if these people, this prosecutor and the judge, had, you know,
had not conspired. See, the hearing today out in San Jose is going to delve into exactly how many cases there are. They're dealing with a specific case in this instance. The case of a gentleman by the name of Fred Freeman, who was sentenced to die in 1987 for killing a bar patron during a robbery out in Berkeley, California. And Quatman prosecuted that trial, and he said he colluded with Superior Court Judge Stanley Gold, who passed away, as we mentioned earlier, in 1998. Now, Judge Gold, were he alive, might face some serious sanction if these allegations. And right now we have to emphasize these are allegations.
Yes.
If they were, you know, if they turned out to be true, Judge Gold would have a very serious problem on his hands. He has passed away. Quatman is now practicing law in Montana. He's not even in California anymore. And there are questions about his credibility. But if even a scintilla of this is true, Mick, it is, first of all, going to send shockwaves through the California justice system, because some people on death row may at the very least get new trials. But the other side of this is the question of collusion between a judge and a prosecutor.
Sure. Man.
You're not supposed to be sitting down saying who's going to be on a jury. What are you, nuts?
And I guess this case is already being invoked by people trying to keep death row inmates alive.
Well, yeah. And see, people have said this over the years, that there have been these kinds of situations where people don't want certain races or certain ethnicities hearing particular cases because of perceived biases or perceived proclivities of that particular group. Whether it's, now, not all black women, not all Jews would have a problem with the death penalty.
Sure.
But if you're playing the percentages, which is what a lot of people in the legal system do, then you might say, and remember that peremptory challenges mean you don't have to give a reason. You don't have to tell anybody why you're doing this. Now, if it turns out, however, that a judge and a prosecutor sat down together, and according to Quatman, he said Judge Gold actually took him to task for not excusing a Jewish juror from a death penalty case. You know, saying essentially, what are you, nuts? You know, and again, these are allegations on the part of Quatman. He has credibility problems. This hearing is really looking to try and get into the veracity of his claims.
Now, what I find odd is that suddenly the death penalty is back in the news. I mean, you heard literally nothing about the death penalty in the election year.
No, you heard very little about it. And one of the things that's interesting in this is that there are now new efforts, particularly on the part of Catholic bishops, to try and get the death penalty outlawed.
And is the conservative right going to play up those issues? Are they going to play up those concerns?
My guess is probably not. But, you know, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is now saying that even among Catholics, the death penalty, you know, the attitude about the death penalty is much more evenly split than it used to be. You go back to the 70s, early 80s, there were large numbers of people in America, including large numbers of Catholics, who were in favor of the death penalty. Now some recent polling says it's split 50-50.
Yeah, here's a quote from Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, who said, "We cannot teach that killing is wrong by killing. We cannot defend life by taking life."
That's an incredible quote.
Yeah, it's a great quote.
It's something to live by. That's
and
for sure.
Yeah, and the Pope, I believe, is on record against the death penalty also.
So am I, actually. I don't believe in the death penalty under any circumstances. It's one of those things like the First Amendment. I don't believe that you can be halfway for the death penalty.
See, no, I am halfway for
You're
it.
You're halfway. I knew you were.
In theory and in principle, I'm against it.
All right. Because, hold that thought.
Okay.
We're going to come back after the break and talk about why Mick Foley is halfway for the death penalty. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is out. He's back next Monday. Wrestling legend Mick Foley is with us in studio as our special guest co-host. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking to Mick's old college professor at SUNY Cortland, Robert Thompson. He's now at Syracuse.
Yeah, I think he'd want you to state that he's now at Syracuse.
He's at Syracuse. Stepping up, huh?
Well, Cortland has really come into its own as a respected university, but he is at Syracuse and is a leading spokesman or leading authority on television and popular culture.
Yeah, we're going to talk popular culture, decency, indecency, et cetera, in our next hour. Right now we're talking about the death penalty and a case that has the potential to shake up not just the California legal system, but American jurisprudence as well. We're talking about a hearing that's going to be taking place in San Jose, California, later today, and it is of claims by a former Alameda County prosecutor named John Jack Quatman, who quit, by the way, in 1997. He moved to Montana time back then. He dropped a bomb when he said that prosecutors systematically eliminated Jews from and black women from juries in death penalty cases, and that a judge, who's now passed away, actually colluded with him in eliminating Jews from juries in death penalty cases in Alameda County. Now, Mick, the numbers are astonishing when you start thinking about this. Non-Jews were excluded from juries in Alameda County at a rate of 49.97%, you know, in other words, almost half. Jews and people with Jewish surnames were excluded at a rate of 93.1%.
Whoa, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, I'm going to say that again, folks, so you heard that clearly. 49.97% non-Jews, 93.1% Jews. That's almost 9.5 out of every 10 Jewish jurors.
So if I get called for jury duty, I'm changing my name to Folstein. I don't want to be part of that.
Now, the probability of the prosecution randomly excluding 27 of 29 Jews, because those are the numbers that we're talking about, is less than 1 in 1.6 million. That's right, 1 in 1.6 million. In other words, that prosecutors would have randomly gotten rid of these Jews, not because they were Jewish, but because of something else. You know, they don't like the way they look, their feet hurt, whatever. That's what we're talking about.
That's astonishing.
Yeah, and it, by the way, these numbers back up Jack Quatman's allegations. Now, I don't know whether they, you know, the specifics of his allegations that he colluded with the late Judge Stanley Gold. Stanley Gold's kids, by the way, both of whom work in the legal profession, are saying, gee, isn't it convenient that he's bringing all this up a few years after my father died and can't defend himself? But the fact of the matter is, if it's true, and we don't know that yet, that's what the courts are for, but if it's true, it is truly scary and could really result in the reopening of a whole bunch of death penalty cases in Alameda County. Now, there is one other individual in addition to Fred Freeman, who we mentioned earlier, who this case centers around. There's another guy by the name of Mark Schmeck, who was tried in 1989, and prosecutors in that case used peremptory challenges to remove two prospective Jewish jurors. Judge Gold, however, was not hearing that particular case. There are 44 people from Alameda County on California's death row, and 8 of them had Judge Gold. Judge Gold was by far the person that sentenced people to death in Alameda County more than any other single judge during his time on the bench. And I believe he had been on the bench for something on the order of 25 years. So we see the dimensions of this particular case and the implications of. And by the way, these are not new implications. They are not unique to California. I remember I was working here in New York when these same kind of allegations came up in the late 70s, early 80s.
And even Judge Gold, I guess, brought up the case of Adolf Eichmann when he was apprehended after World War II, and there was actually a major controversy in Israel
yeah.
over whether he should be sentenced to be executed. I mean, there was one guy begging to be executed, it'd be Adolf Eichmann. And if there was a controversy over that, I guess maybe there is something to that.
Well, you know, I mean, there was certainly a controversy about Eichmann, but to make the leap from that to the idea of Jews not wishing to impose a death penalty, or maybe they're specifically talking about California's modality in the gas chamber, and maybe they just figure that with the Holocaust, the idea of gas chambers might be repugnant to some Jews. I don't know whether that's what they're, you know, what this allegation is all about. All I know is it is reprehensible behavior on the part of people who are sworn to uphold the law to collude like this together, if that's what happened, to reach that kind of end, because it means that people are not getting fair trials.
Sure, and it means, like I alluded to earlier, that people may be dead who should not be.
Yeah, yeah,
who would not otherwise be dead had they, maintain the letter of the law.
Now, Mick, you got some splaining to do, because you said
I'm
you were halfway for the death penalty.
Let me say, if you looked at me, I was kind of zoning out here, which is not unusual for a guy who's been hit in the head as many times as I have. But I was actually having a flashback to sitting on the bus in Japan in 1995, listening to the Steve Earle song, Billy Austin, which is just an amazing song about capital punishment. And there's a line in there that says, could you still pull the switch, sir, with a sure and steady hand? And could you still tell yourself, sir, that you're better than I am? And I asked Terry Funk, who's a noted West Texan,
wrestling legend, to listen
to the song. And Terry Funk, he sat there and he listened to the whole thing. It's about a 6-minute song, and he gave me the headphones. He said, "You're damn right, I could pull that switch." But that is a good song.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, even people I'm close to have, you know, they have very strong feelings. Me, in practice, I mean, in theory and in principle, I don't want to see people killed. But as a father, I cannot assure you that if something were to happen to one of my kids that I wouldn't want to see.
I know.
I mean, I would be a hypocrite to say no to some parent. You can't see that the person who killed your child die, but that I would want to at least have that on the table. As a parent, and you know, obviously that's a situation I pray will never
never occur.
To pass.
Sure.
Yeah.
Look, I have a child, and you know, have seen a couple of children to adulthood, and yeah, again, God forbid anything happened to them, I would want to see that person locked away with no hope of ever being released. Parole in a case of first degree murder, I think, is a travesty, but I don't believe that the state has the right to commit homicide. Because what the death penalty, to me, is state-sponsored homicide.
And where I have an issue is because there have been so many innocent people sentenced to death.
Yeah.
And you know that prosecutors, almost like they're patting their record. You know, they pat themselves on the back if they get that death penalty.
Yeah.
That's what they're going for. Anything less than that, to some prosecutors, is seen as a failure. And that, to me, is reprehensible.
Yeah, and see, the idea that you can never go back and admit that a mistake was made. We've seen case after case after case where people have been exonerated over the objections of prosecutors who don't want to look at the evidence that may prove someone was wrongly convicted, but instead say the system said this person should die, so it doesn't matter whether the person's innocent or guilty. I saw somebody on the Texas Board of Pardons and Parole say that to a direct question from a reporter. Said, this guy is innocent. Well, that doesn't matter.
Just a little teaser for our Brent Bozell conversation. He actually entered the mainstream, so to speak, over the Willie Horton debate.
Wow.
He, together with Floyd Brown, put together that little commercial, I believe. He may have done something else with Floyd Brown. Floyd Brown may have been the sole architect of that. I may be wrong. But he had something to do with Floyd Brown, who put the Willie Horton commercial together.
Oh, okay, yeah, under Lee Atwater's office.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, that was just a way, and they knew, even though President Bush, the 41st, asked them to take it down, John Sununu directly asked Bozell to take it down, and he said, hey, we want the controversy. When we get controversy, people make donations, and that's what we want, knowing that the news shows would air the Horton commercial over and over. So that's how Brent Bozell entered the public fray.
Well, we're going to enter him in our fray in the next hour here on Morning's Edition. We're going to talk about decency. We're going to talk about Brent Bozell. I guess maybe they shouldn't even be in the same sentence, Brent Bozell and decency. But we'll get to that. And we'll also talk to Syracuse University Professor Robert Thompson. All coming up here on Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Six minutes past the hour, and this is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off, and we've got a very special guest co-host. And by the way, Mark will be back next Monday, because I know how, you know, people get, you know, into their conspiracy theories. Maron is on the West Coast. He will be back on Monday. Don't forget that and spread it to your friends on the blog. Right now, our special guest co-host, wrestling legend and best-selling author, Mick Foley.
And guess what, Mark?
What?
I got to do the pom-pom.
Yeah. I mean, that was, you did a good job.
Really?
I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Are people making comparisons with Maron?
No.
No, not yet?
I don't know.
Unfavorable even?
No. Right. Nobody's going to make comparisons.
It's good. I even remember to crumple up the page.
I think you could kick his butt in the fight, though.
That's better be able to kick his butt.
Now, as those of you who heard our news earlier may know, and some of you who are just waking up may not know, A federal judge has refused to order the reinsertion of Terri Schiavo's feeding tube. She is the Florida woman, of course, who has been comatose for the last 15 years. And there is a raging battle going on that Congress has gotten involved with as to whether or not her feeding tube, not life support, but a feeding tube, should be inserted or left out. And if the tube is taken out, she will die in something on the order of 2 weeks, according to doctors.
So as a result of their late night vote 2 days ago or early yesterday morning,
yes,
the conservatives, in a sense, got what they wanted. They got a federal ruling, but the ruling was not what they wanted.
Well, no, the ruling is not what they wanted. We have not heard yet. We probably will in pretty short order during the course of the day, whether the parents and the Congress will pursue any other remedy here.
Is there any other remedy?
They may have an appeal. They may be able to appeal this to another court. You know, I don't know if it's going to be any more availing. It seems like many legal experts quoted in the papers across the country are saying they didn't think that there was much of a chance the parents would prevail in the first place. Now, the parents want to make sure that the feeding tube stays in and that Terri Schiavo remains alive. What's interesting about this, Mick, and we talked on, we touched on this a bit yesterday, is the idea that there is video of Terri Schiavo that has been very widely circulated and has been, according to some published reports, the catalyst for Congress to get involved. Bill Frist in the Senate, who is himself a doctor,
yes,
apparently saw the video, or at least from what he says, and was moved to act based on, you know, this troubling video of this woman who in the videos looks very much alive and who looks like, you know, why would you then, you know, take the tube out and kill her? That seems to be the argument that Congress is following. People who oppose the bill that Congress passed, which the president signed, which kicked this thing into a federal court, don't say that they're necessarily in favor of this, of this woman being essentially put to death, but they do say that Congress is reaching way too far into people's bedrooms, way too far into what should be, under normal circumstances, private decisions about life and death.
And one of the big debates here is, without a will, it is a matter of who gets to decide. Is it Terri Schiavo's husband, who has been documented as having a couple children with another woman after his wife's misfortune, or is it the parents? You know, I side with the parents. Personally, I look at that video, I feel like she should be allowed to die with dignity, but I feel it should be up to the parents, not a husband.
Not the husband. But the husband's been appointed guardian.
Legally. Well,
then, that's why he's got standing.
I stand corrected then. Right. But I see it as a humbling defeat for President Bush, who was actually summoned from Texas to sign this bill, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I assume he would only do that if he had reason to believe that it would be put into law by a federal judge.
Yeah, and, you know, the conservatives really saw this as a very, very big juggernaut and a great political issue for them, which actually came out in the memo, which Fritz later came.
Or was it a case for the president where he just politically could not afford to not sign it?
Sign it, yeah. It's very interesting. Now, we're going to be getting into, during this hour, the whole issue of decency. Time magazine has a very big story that includes a great deal of copy about a guy you know a great deal
yes.
about. And we're talking, of course, about L. Brent Bozell, who is the head of the Parents Television Council and also oversees the ETS, the Entertainment Tracking System, which before I read this piece, I knew absolutely nothing about. But first, Mick, for people who don't know this guy, who is Brent Bozell? Because you got history.
Yeah, we do have history. L. Brent Bozell III is the son of a very prominent person, L. Brent Bozell II, who was a roommate of William F. Buckley Jr.'s at Yale. Buckley is usually given sole credit for writing God and Man at Yale, but that was actually co-written along with I may be wrong. It may be the book that they co-wrote was McCarthy and His Enemies, which was a very pro-McCarthy book, a book that McCarthy himself said was too intellectual for him to understand. So as a writer, one thing I will never be accused of is writing over my subjects' heads. No one ever looks at my stuff as too intellectual to understand. But I know that he did co-found the National Review
yes.
with William F. Buckley, Jr., and later went on to become a speechwriter for Senator McCarthy. Now, when I was doing this research, you have to understand, I'm computer illiterate.
That's Bozell's dad was a speechwriter.
He was a speechwriter for McCarthy.
Okay.
It turned out that I read a very good book by a prize-winning author named David Oshinsky called A Conspiracy So Immense, which even Pat Buchanan said was the leading book on Senator McCarthy. And being somebody who's not technically proficient and is not computer literate, I would just get on the phone. I'd say, okay, Princeton University, let me call up Princeton Information. Can I speak to David Oshinsky? And he actually returned my phone call.
Oh, wow.
Spoke to me for about a half an hour. And when I asked about the split between Buckley and Bozell Sr., he said they split of all things because Bozell was becoming too conservative
for Buckley's
taste. Yeah, and I said, wow, how conservative you have to be too conservative for William F. Buckley? And he said, just about as conservative as you can be, or about as far to the right as you can be without completely falling off. So far, and I don't mean to put him down, because I believe that, and I will put him down here in a minute.
Yes.
But I'm saying, I mean, I respect people who stand up for their beliefs, but Brent Bozell wants to champion family values. And I knew when I was growing up, family values was my dad taking me to Yankee games,
yeah,
you know,
exactly,
for my birthday. Brent Bozell's dad took him to Spain where they were trying to restore the Spanish monarchical succession. So his was not a typical childhood. You know, his father, yeah, his dad ran for Congress, was a very intelligent guy, apparently a real proficient writer, and actually wrote ghost wrote Conscience of a Conservative, which, you know, in the scheme of things, was far more important than Foley is Good or Have a Nice Day or
sure?
even Tales from Rescue Lane. So this is not a lightweight guy. And I think the case with his son is he's a guy who means well and wants to try to live up to the family name and has cut an enormous path in this whole decency thing. But in my opinion, he's a guy who should have absolutely zero credibility in the decency wars because of, in my opinion, the indecent things he did in his campaign against WWE and their SmackDown television show.
Now, that campaign was the subject of a great deal of media, but its outcome and its resolution is not as well known. When we come back, we're going to talk about your encounters with L. Brent Bozell. And it was a case of SmackDown, all right. He got smacked down. Mick Foley is our special guest.
He was beaten down by a wrestler with a library card.
There you go. Stay with us. We're right back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Cholesterol. 19 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is back next Monday. Mick Foley, professional wrestling legend and best-selling author, is here with us in studio. He's our guest co-host this morning. Tomorrow morning, be listening, because Laura Flanders of our own Laura Flanders Show here on Air America will be our special guest co-host. Mick, we're talking about decency, indecency, and L. Brent Bozell. Now, one of the things that we need to let our audience know is that Congress appears to be on the verge of giving the FCC, they've already given the FCC more power to fine people and fine broadcast outlets over indecency. They have taken up the issue of whether or not individuals should be held personally liable for indecency over the airwaves. And they're also, George W. Bush named a new FCC chair, Kevin Martin, young guy, about 38 years old. He talks tougher about indecency than his predecessor, Michael Powell, does. So it looks like people are starting to pay attention to this. How much credit do you give L. Brent Bozell for all this flurry of activity?
Apparently, he's the catalyst, and what he is able to do through his emails and through his complaints about indecency is he's able to take a very limited number of participants in his parents' television council and create the feeling and atmosphere of having real power. It's the same thing he did with his sponsors' boycott of SmackDown. He was able to exaggerate the number of sponsors who had actually pulled their claims, and by exaggerating the number, was able to appeal to other sponsors who would then pull for fear of being castigated. So by creating the impression of having real power, he actually creates real power. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Now, tell us how, your first inkling that Brent Bozell was going to mess with your business.
My first inkling was actually, I believe, in late 98. It may have been 99 when I realized that WWE has switched to Pepsi products.
Really?
And that they had actually like taped over a Coca-Cola machine. And we'd had Coca-Cola products for years. And when I asked why, they said it was because Coke had pulled their sponsorship from WWE television at the parent PTC's bequest.
Wow.
And a number of sponsors started pulling. And they did so because, like I said, alluded to, they were creating the impression that a number of other sponsors who had never sponsored to begin with had pulled their ads. And this was based on an Indiana University study that over a 52-week period on our Raw show, and I believe this was based on a 1998 study, said there were 157 instances of wrestlers or audience members giving the finger, 434 instances of the slogan, suck it, sorry for that, being said by wrestlers or appearing on signs of the audience, 1,658 instances of wrestlers groping or pointing to their crotches, 128 instances of simulated sexual activity, 42 instances of simulated drug use, 47 references to satanic activity, and 609 instances of wrestlers being hit by objects like garbage cans or nightsticks. So I was in the middle of researching this. My first book had done surprisingly, shockingly well,
yeah.
You know, and
bestseller.
So, yeah, and at the time I'd written it from pure motives. You know, I just wanted to have the story out there. It never dawned on me that people would read this thing. So as soon as it became a success, I looked for a follow up. Now I was writing from purely financial motives. But I started researching a year in the life as opposed to an autobiography, and I was coming up with very different findings. I looked at 25 episodes of SmackDown and Raw combined. And I came up, and I averaged it out for a 52-week period, and I came out with 34 instances of wrestlers or audience members giving the finger, 604 instances of wrestlers grabbing or pointing their crotches. That's indefensible.
Mm-hmm.
0 instances of simulated sexual activity, 0 instances of simulated drug use, 0 instances of satanic activity, and 422 instances of wrestlers being hit by objects like garbage cans or nightsticks. Now, you know, there is, to me, no excuse for the suck it slogan. I have no idea how that became part of the American lexicon.
Mm-hmm.
The crotch pointing was actually not pointing. That was the chopping, you know.
That was X-Pac.
That was X-Pac. And I even, you know, and I'll get to my conversation with the professor who did this study. I said, you know, X-Pac was accountable for like 9/10 of all the crotch chops, you know. And I said, you know, technically he's pointing his fingers away from the genital area.
Yeah.
And he comes out and he does them in quick bursts of about 10 chops. And I said to the professor, would that be 10 points or one big one? He said, no, that, you know, of course it'd be 10. And that chop became such a big thing that I was at Disneyland with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Disney characters, they can't talk unless they're a face character like Snow White or Sleeping Beauty or one of those people. But it became obvious that Pooh Bear was trying to get my attention. And my wife's like, I think Pooh is trying to get your attention. I look over, and Pooh Bear gives me the crotch chop to let me know that he's in, you know?
Oh, wow.
So what I did is I called up the professor at Indiana University, and the only reason I called, I figure I'll call him 5 times, and he won't answer, and then I'll say he was unavailable for comment. But he actually did call me back. He couldn't have been nicer, discussed this thing. We had our differences of opinions. And, you know, one of the things I said was, you know, well, when you put together the list of people being hit in the head with garbage cans and chairs and whatnot, I said, would you be counting strictly the number of times it happened live, or would you be counting instant replays and B-rolls?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you know, if it was on the air, I counted it. I said, so B-rolls, instant replays? He said, yes. And so I taken down my notes, and he said, well, wouldn't you? I said, well, no. He said, you wouldn't. I said, no. He said, why? I said, well, for example, if Major League Baseball contacted me to see how many home runs Mark McGwire had hit, I don't think I'd count the instant replays and B-rolls. I said, for example, I was a guy who took a lot of punishment in my career and probably set some type of Guinness World Record for being hit in the head with hard obstacles. I said, but I'm retired. I haven't been hit in the head in over a year, but when I come down to the ring...
I haven't been hit in the head in over a year.
But when I come down to the ring, my video shows the Mick Foley's greatest hits. I was the only wrestler in history to have his entrance video comprised completely of me getting the bleep beaten out of me. But where it got, you know, serious, where I said, you know, as far as the sexuality, I said, you know, I didn't see any simulated sex. And he pointed to an episode with Sexual Chocolate, Mark Henry, and something involving a transsexual.
The one with May.
No, not that one. There was something where he got confused with a transsexual, and I said, all right, I'll give you that. That wasn't one of them I watched, but I know what you're talking about. I said, but I didn't see anything else. Because when you think of simulated sexual activity, what comes to mind?
Softcore porn. Okay. But I'm a horn dog, so you can't count me.
So he says to me, he goes, well, that would be, for example, a woman touching a man's arm. And
what?
I said, Professor, isn't that a little misleading? He said, well, not if it was done suggestively.
Not in Indiana.
Not if it was done suggestively. I said, well, I find that a little misleading. And then I went on to the drug, simulated drug use. Because when I hear simulated drug use, I'm thinking of a needle
somebody
hitting a vein.
Right? Yeah, right.
So I say, would that be, for example, like, you know, the Godfather saying, roll a fatty for this pimp daddy, light that thing up and say, pimping ain't easy. He said, no. And I said, would it be someone saying, your bleep is grass and I'm going to smoke it? And he said, no. And I said, well, Professor, you know, I really didn't see any simulated drug use. And he said, and I kid you not, he said, that would be beer drinking.
I knew that's where it was, so it was stone cold.
So it was stone cold every time he popped the top, you know. Simulated drug use. He said, well, it clearly is marked simulated drug and alcohol use. I said, Professor, I've seen your study cited in over 110 newspapers, magazines, and television shows. Never once has it been labeled as simulated alcohol and drug use. So it's misleading, and even sadder is the idea that not one person, by his own admission, I was the only person, journalist or otherwise, to even question the results of the study. To me, that's downright scary, and it led people to abandon WWE who should have never abandoned the product.
We're back with Planet Bush and Professor Robert Thompson, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour, it's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with you next Monday. Mick Foley, wrestling legend and best-selling author, is our guest. If you're on your way out the door, by the way, you're paying 12 cents more a gallon for gas. Man, it's hitting record high. Some scary stuff. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have someone who lives in that world. So now, on the phone once again, is Planet Bush Bureau Chief Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark Riley. God's the mechanic. We're just spare parts. And I just want to say that my prayers are with you during this difficult time.
Lawton, what are you talking about?
Well, Air America Radio finally got rid of that Mark Maron, and I know that must be difficult for you, though I'm sure it isn't for the audience, though. I expect they must be hugely relieved not to have to listen to him go on and on about his dreams and his cats and his eating habits and whatever.
Lawton! Lawton! Maron's on vacation, Lawton. He will be back Monday.
I know all the code words, Mark. Vacation, Monday. You're hurting. And as a God-fearing man, I respect your suffering.
Lawton!
I admire the way you stand up for him, but, you know, just between us, he was verbally abusive to me every week. You know, it played havoc on my nerves. I'm a sensitive man, you know. He's a bully, really. A thug, isn't he? I mean, I'm so glad he's been replaced. I can sleep now. Why don't you introduce me to your new partner?
Maron will be back Monday, Lawton. But since you asked... Here's Mick Foley.
Hey, nice to meet you, Lawton. I listen all the time.
Well, this is a breath of fresh air. Mick Foley. Wait a minute. Mick Foley, the wrestler?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, no. You know Brent Bozell of the Parents Television Council? He's a good friend of mine. He told me all about you. The violence, the tight body-hugging suggestive costumes, the sheer girth of the thing. You got to forgive me for saying this, but wrestling is obscene. Mick Foley. It's dangerous.
Come on, Lawton. It's innocent escapist entertainment.
Well, maybe an escape from every good and decent thing in the world. Wrestling leads to Satanism, drugs, liberalism, homosexuality.
Wait, you're making these judgments. I don't even think you've seen wrestling. Have you ever watched wrestling? Have you ever one single time sat down and watched professional wrestling?
Have I ever watched wrestling? How can you even ask me that? The fall from the hell in a cell, Mr. Socko, when the Undertaker threw you off the top of the cell, I had to go to bed for a week. That's how much I watched. That really hurts me. You know, Merritt always tries to make me feel better when I cry.
He does, huh?
Yeah.
Would you like a hug?
Yes.
Well, you're not getting one. Quit your crying, you wimp. You conniving, conservative con man. You clinking, clanking collection of collisionist junk.
Riley, please bring back Marin, please. This man frightens me.
Monday, Lawton. Monday.
He frightens me.
God loves you, Lawton. Deal with it.
God.
Wow. You stole his line,
man. Oh,
man,
did I ever. Not only that, I stole the Wizard of Oz's line, too.
There you go.
That made no sense at all. Clinking, clanking, collection of collisions, junk. That's what the wizard said to the Tin Man.
Yeah, I know, but you've seen Lawton Small, man. Right now.
I'm on. What a rush that was.
Yeah,
it was. Better than the Palm Pilot.
Right now, we are pleased to have on the telephone from Syracuse, New York, Professor Robert Thompson, director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University, also a trustee of that school, and he taught our guest co-host Mick Foley back in the day at SUNY Cortland, and he says that Mick is the only former student of his to have his own action figure. Professor, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Bob, how are you?
Pretty good.
Can I call you Bob on the air?
I still dress up as Mick Foley. Not just for watching wrestling.
Speaking of dressing up, can I make a shocking? It's not a confession. It is what Professor Thompson. It's a startling accusation. Do you know what I'm talking about, Bob?
No, I don't.
This is my senior year. We're getting ready to graduate, and I turned in what I thought was a tremendous end of the year project. And during the course of the project, it was about a professor, Terry Hidson, who was a thinly veiled cartoon or a caricature of a professor, Terry Hudson, which didn't sit well with our teacher. And what he was doing is in an attempt to become the only fertile man in Cortland and therefore the only suitable choice for procreation, he was conniving and convincing the Cortland residents that the remedy to every one of their ills was to have their genitalia removed.
What?
And it ended up only one man caught on to the scheme and had it out with Professor Hidson in a scene where Professor Hidson is actually dipping into the removed body parts and is hurling them at his combatant, complete with a close-up of body part hitting the wall. They were cherry tomatoes, except when it came to the Mick Foley body parts, in which case they were huge Idaho potatoes.
Oh, my God.
And I look at it, and I'm looking for Bob Thompson's approval. And I said, what do you think, Professor Thompson? Do you remember what you said?
I don't.
He said that it was a sign that I secretly longed to be a woman. And I waited for the punchline.
That was the punchline.
And there was no punchline. And my friends looked at me a little differently after that.
Well, you know, I've read your novels, I've read your books, I've watched your work, and I pretty much still stand by them.
Professor Thompson, you know, Time Magazine has a cover story this week on television and indecency. We've heard the Congress talking about possibly extending Federal Communications Commission's regulations broadcast cable in some cases. Some folks, Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, wants to go as far as being able to regulate HBO and Showtime and some of these premium channels. What do you think of all of this focus on indecency?
Well, you know, this stuff goes back to the Pilgrims' time. What we say we want as Americans and that we think is good and that we think is right has always been very different from what we actually do. If you read the record that the people of Plymouth Plantation wrote and then you look at the court records of the things they actually did, very, very different sorts of things. I think there's a lot of people out there who fill out surveys. Yes, the FCC should clean up TV. Yes, there's too much sex on television. Yes, the language needs to be cleaned up. And while the right hand is filling out the survey, the left hand is flipping through the dials and actually watching all this stuff that they're complaining about. There's two forces afoot here, the forces of righteous indignation and the forces of the marketplace, and they are completely at odds with one another.
Now, that's been the case since the Puritans' time. What happened back then?
Well, I mean, you once again, you read what the Puritans were talking about, this wonderfully religious, values-based society. If you look at the records of Plymouth Plantation, lots of people being charged with fornication, adultery, bestiality, yes, the Pilgrims, Plymouth, these kinds of things. I mean, there's a sense here that all of this hand-wringing and all of these things going on.
Men wanting to be women.
It's, you know, one has to, I think, to judge what community community standards are, which is, of course, what the indecency rule is based on, not upon what we've seen on television in the old days when people slept in separate beds, but the way Americans actually act and behave. And that's a very different set of standards.
You know, it's fascinating to me, Professor, that this Time magazine article talks about, and I think this is probably the way most people perceive it, that a lot of this is done in the name of keeping indecency and or obscenity away from children. But then there seems to be a question of whether or not the people who advocate, like the PTC, the Parents Television Council, and others, are talking about their own kids or other people's kids. Which one do you think they're talking about?
Well, and the whole question is if this is really about the kids in the first place. It's true. I'm sympathetic with parents who now have to treat the television set in a very different way than they did when I was a kid. When I was a kid, you could sit your kid in front of the TV set, and with the exception of the news, virtually everything that poured out of there was okay for a kid. The advantage of that was a kid could watch anything. The disadvantage is that nothing was more sophisticated than what was okay for an eight-year-old. The TV does now have to be treated more like the liquor cabinet. There is stuff in there that that isn't good for kids. I'm very glad the world now has programming for adults, The Sopranos and The Shield and all the rest of it. I wouldn't want to sit a nine-year-old in front of an episode of The Sopranos, but I wouldn't want it to go away any more than, you know, you don't let your kids have the keys to the car, but you don't want to outlaw automobiles.
Bob. You're pretty familiar with L. Brent Bozell, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
And we've spoken over the phone many times about this. Bob was a contributor and quoted often in my book, Foley is Good, which was a New York Times number one bestseller. And I don't know if the public at large is aware of the outcome of the WWE versus PTC lawsuit. But I'd like to quote a little bit. This is a letter of retraction following the lawsuit. And it says, in specifically here, as it pertains to the claim that we were killing children, it says, we were told by a source that Lionel Tate was watching a WWE program when he assaulted Tiffany Eunuch. In fact, Lionel Tate was watching the Flintstones and a cartoon entitled Cow and Chicken.
Now, this refers to a kid, I believe he was 12 years old, in Florida.
This is the case that the PTC really staked their claim on. This is what they went to bat with. This is it was a nationwide case. The kid was sentenced to life imprisonment. It was later overturned. But the judge at the time said it was inconceivable that this had anything to do with wrestling. And later on, when the appeal was heard, his new attorney essentially admitted the whole wrestling thing was bogus. So, Bob, my question is, in a case like this where they are so clearly wrong, and that's only one small sentence in what is seen as an unprecedented two-page letter of retraction that was on their own website for 6 months, with the evidence of such a shocking defeat, how in the world does L. Brent Bozell or the PTC still have an ounce of credibility?
Well, because being wrong in this day and age does not necessarily ruin your credibility. There are a lot of people out there who are operating with a lot of political power who have been pointed out as being wrong constantly. I think people are so completely programmed to believe this, we are what we watch kind of thing, and especially when it comes to kids, that no matter when the evidence comes in to the contrary, however much rational argument is brought forth to the contrary, they still want to lean on the fact that television is the cause of all this. And I think in some ways it's because it's comforting to think that if you could simply clean up television, the clouds would part, the rainbow would come down, we'd all join hands together. The big thing is, Hitler didn't have television. Attila the Hun didn't have television. The Spanish Inquisitors didn't have television.
Professor Thompson, hold that thought for 1 second. We have to take a quick break. Our very special guest, Mick Foley's former college professor and trustee and professor of television and popular culture at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications, Professor Robert Thompson. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
One minute past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with you next Monday. Mick Foley, professional wrestling.
You, what
legend.
You're doing is you're confusing the word professor.
Professor.
Yeah. You're about to speak to Professor Thompson and professional wrestler.
That's right. We're talking to Syracuse University Professor Robert Thompson. We're talking about all things media, all things decent and indecent. And Professor, before the break, you were talking about a couple of things, and I know Mick wanted to talk about the resolution of the case of the PTC versus the WWE.
I did.
Yeah.
I guess I did. As it turned out, I was, I don't know if you knew this, Bob, but my materials were summoned. The PTC asked for them. And when I asked our attorney why they would want my materials, he said, I think they're under the impression that you just wrote what we told you to. And I became offended, you know, as a scholar, I was offended. And so I have a box that I actually presented Mark Riley with, still taped up. But I ended up sending everything I could think of, notebooks, every little bit of information I used, I sent to them. And I don't know if it was just coincidence or not, but 3 days later, PTC settled for many millions of dollars.
Always keep that stuff.
Now, there's a question I want to ask. Is through parenting and the vaunted V-chip, is the PTC's babysitting services really necessary, and what is your feeling on the V-chip and its popularity or lack thereof?
Well, the V-chip has got its advantages and disadvantages. It's on every TV after 2000 by law, and used with the rating system, you can actually get rid of a good chunk of the stuff that you wouldn't want your kids to watch by simply taking out the TV MAs and the whatever rating system you think is the bar that you want to set. The problem is that parents, while they make a lot of noise about how worried they are about what's on TV, very, very few of them have ever bothered to even figure out how to use this V-chip, which, by the way, isn't hard to figure out. Most people don't even know they've got a V-chip on their television set, and they're making no effort to find out. Matter of fact, most kids probably are more likely to be able to program the V-chip. Any parent that actually got the thing engaged would probably... I can picture, honey, daddy wants to watch Die Hard 2. Would you come in and disengage me?
Honey, get rid of the chip.
I put the block and everything R and over.
Yeah, and you know, any parent that wanted to do this, it's the idea that I think people would rather wring their hands and make a fuss about this kind of stuff than they would actually do what they need to do. You don't give your kids the car keys if they can't drive. You don't give them the key to the gun cabinet. The television set is now something that doesn't have everything in it. A lot of it's not appropriate for kids, and it has to be managed accordingly.
Now, Professor Thompson, we got a new chair of the FCC. His name is Kevin Martin.
Oh, yeah.
And there are some people who are a little nervous about his ascendancy. Are you one of them?
Yeah, as well they should be. This is a guy that actually dissented on the opinion about finding those stations for showing Saving Private Ryan. He's a guy that not only wants to throw out the baby, Howard Stern, or the bathwater, I mean, in good cases of Howard Stern and Opie and Anthony and the rest of it. He wants to throw out the baby as well. Good stuff. Saving Private Ryan on Veterans Day. Saving Private Ryan is a lot of things. It's violent. It's got bad language. But there is no way any thinking person would ever put that under the category of indecent.
How do you, Professor, define indecency?
Well, I guess the only way to define it is according to how it's defined in the rule. That's what's supposed to be enforced, and that is anything of a scatological or sexual nature that is deemed patently offensive according to standard community standards.
Oh, man, that's 70% of my wrestling material.
Stop.
Right out the window.
But it depends. First of all, you've got to come up with a rational use of community standards. I mean, obviously, you can't get community standards consensus around a dinner table, much less in a whole town or a whole nation. But if you judge community standards by how television used to look in the 1950s, husband and wife in separate beds, no talk of sexuality, all of that, then I suppose just about anything could be indecent that's on TV.
You said something to me years ago in a phone conversation that really struck me. You said in some ways, like Andy Griffith was offensive in that it didn't even begin to approach subjects of the day, that that Andy Griffith was the sheriff of a small southern town, but you never saw
black people, yeah.
Right. I mean, in many ways, so much of what's on television we should be complaining about more than simply, naughty language and an occasional double entendre and stuff. Let's take the Super Bowl and Janet Jackson. If you are a rational parent, which is more upsetting to you? Let's say you've got a 12-year-old watching the show. Half a second of Janet Jackson's breast from 100 yards, or 29 beer commercials that associate beer with, you know, sexy lifestyle and beautiful people and fun and all the rest of it. To me, we are barking up the wrong tree. If the NFL is really supposed to be this wonderful moment where we snuggle up with the kids on the couch and watch football, there's a lot of other stuff on that we should be disturbed about besides that little breast, which every kid has seen at some point in their life anyway.
You know, money talks, that's for sure. Professor Thompson, it's been a real pleasure having you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And, Mick, I know you're confident in your masculinity.
You take care, Professor.
Thanks. Thank you, Bob.
Professor Robert Thompson from Syracuse University. We want to find out from you in our listening audience how you define indecency. Do you know it when you see it? Do you feel it when you see it? How do you know when something's indecent? How do you set that standard for your children? 1-866-303-2270 is our number. 1-866-303-2270. We're back after the break. Morning's Edition, Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley, and Mark Maron is on vacation, a well-deserved rest, I might say. He will be back next Monday, so you conspiracy theorists, bloggers, and otherwise, don't fret. Maron will return. Right now, we are pleased to have with us in studio our special guest co-host for the last 2 days, Mr. Mick Foley, professional wrestling legend and best-selling author.
And Palm Pilot reader extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire for sure. Our phone number is 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. We're talking about indecency. When do you know when something is indecent? Is it simply you know it when you see it? Do you take things on a case-by-case basis? If you have children, how do you decide what it is your children watch, what it is your children listen to? Later in the hour, we're going to be talking with famed New York Giants running back Tiki Barber, who has found a parallel career and parallel life as an actor.
But it has nothing to do with indecency.
It has nothing whatsoever to do
this
with
this is not indecency. An indecent play he's starring, is it?
No. When he runs over some lineman, people might see that as indecent because he's a great running back. But right now we're going to you on the phones, 866-303-2270. Let us say good morning to Joan from Ramsey, who's listening on Sirius. Good morning, Joan. How you doing?
Good morning. It's really nice to be able to talk to you guys.
Well, thanks, Joan, for being with us.
Are you including me in that, you guys?
Yes,
nice. All right.
I have two comments, and then I have to get to work because I'm sitting outside of my my school here. The first thing is that I think there's a really big difference between indecency and inappropriateness.
Mm-hmm.
There are many things that I consider inappropriate for children. They're just not capable of comprehending some things and process things differently than adults.
Name one thing that you find inappropriate as opposed to indecent.
I think a lot of innuendo about sexuality is inappropriate for children because they don't understand that the subtlety of language.
Beer commercial?
Excuse me?
The average beer commercial?
Absolutely. Totally.
What about a Viagra commercial?
I think Viagra's inappropriate for young children also, those commercials. They just don't have the capacity to understand the nuance of the language.
Here's an odd thing. I was at a haunters convention where all the Halloween haunters from around the country gather and look to book their haunted attractions and buy new things to scare people. Elvira was there, so I had a chance
Mistress of the Dark.
The Mistress of the Dark, and I was able to get a DVD of her Elvira's Haunted Hills. Now, my four-year-old loved it, and it was loaded with sexual innuendo, but I did not find it inappropriate because the innuendo was so far over his head that I didn't find it offensive.
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
You know, there's also a difference between offensive and inappropriate. There are just some things that kids attempt to... You don't understand the way that he processes that information. Because he's not reacting to the sexuality.
Yeah, and if he had been reacting, like, I would find that inappropriate for my 11 and 13-year-old.
Yes.
But I didn't find it inappropriate for my 4-year-old because he had no idea what she was talking about.
Right. Okay. Hmm. Can I make my other comment?
Yes, please, Joan.
Okay, the other thing that I wanted to say, and that's just food for thought, the difference between indecency and inappropriateness. The other thing is that I consider things indecent when they disparage or exploit another human being. To me, that is the epitome of indecency.
You know, that would cast a pretty wide net. Now, do you think that there ought to be any regulation of inappropriate media?
No, I think it's a parent's responsibility.
Okay. Indecent, however, you would regulate?
You know, regulate is also a pretty broad word. I think that parents have a huge responsibility, and other adults in the community have a huge responsibility. I think that so long as the ratings are conjured by people who have their own agenda,
mm-hmm.
and so long as they're so subject, it's such a subjective issue, really.
Wow, that's interesting.
I have always found violence on, you know, television now is almost entirely criminal shows, and it's grotesquely violent.
Yeah.
I think it's entirely inappropriate for kids.
You notice how she said conjured the ratings? That's a very interesting way of putting it. Joan, thank you very much for the call. The idea that, the ratings may not always be what we think they are.
You know, Mark, I think she made a great point, but I tend to see everything through the scope of professional wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And if you eliminate offensive and degrading material, then you are pretty much eliminating the heat. You know, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, getting heat on your heels. And if you have no heat, you have no comeback. And that doesn't just relate to wrestling, but how do you have a triumph over adversity when so much of adversity would be offensive behavior?
You know, it's interesting, Mick. I wonder sometimes the extent to which parents would be prepared, if this is really about the kids, how much would parents be willing to sacrifice what they watch so their children don't see anything inappropriate?
I don't think they'd be willing to sacrifice very much.
Much of anything.
Much of anything. I know I do a lot of late night viewing. I'm not talking about the softcore stuff. I'm talking about like Sopranos or Six Feet Under. And I have not seen Deadwood, but apparently with all the hoopla, it's something
pretty
that I should
stuff.
Be seeing. Yeah, violent and the language is supposedly extreme, but necessary in the context of the show.
What they're doing. Sure. Let's go next to Marcus, who's calling us from the West Coast in San Francisco. Marcus, how you doing?
Hey, how you guys doing?
All right.
Marcus, you all right?
Oh, yeah, I'm chilling. How you doing?
Okay,
all right.
All right, yeah. I would like to say that the only thing I would find offensive on television would be anything satanic.
Satanic?
Satanic.
Why satanic?
Just it's going a little too far. I don't think... You know, not along the lines of Papa Shango or The Undertaker or anything, but...
I knew he was going to say
Yeah, because when PTC was making their satanic claims, they were specifically
about
dwelling...
The Undertaker.
Well, The Undertaker was doing a satanic-type thing, and my feeling was, you know what, if you eliminate any satanic references, then there goes your X-Files. There goes Escape from Witch Mountain. There goes a good deal of what could pass for... There goes Charmed. You know, there goes anything that deals with mysticism or the occult, or even the Bible, for that matter.
Yeah.
And my feeling on Satan is he is the ultimate bad guy, and since I come from a good guys versus bad guys world, I don't think you can cast out the ultimate bad guy, because Terry Funk, the same guy who said, you're damn right, I could pull that switch, he gave me a long story about, how without the devil, there was no angel. You know, we need the bad guys in order to portray our good guys. So right. I would disagree on that one.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. Let's see if we can get another one in. Let's go next to Amy, who is calling us from Park Slope, Brooklyn, listening to WLIB. Amy, good morning.
Good morning. You know, if I can have Mark Maron, I love having Mick Foley.
Really?
All right.
Wow. And you're you're not a wrestling fan, right?
Cactus Jack.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I thought I was scoring points based on my radio merit.
You are scoring points based on your radio merit.
No, you don't understand. You're both, man. That's awesome.
Well, I appreciate
that. There you go,
that.
Amy.
Wow, thanks.
What do you think, Amy? What constitutes indecency for you? Where do you draw the line?
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't make a habit of this, but yesterday I was watching Dr. Phil.
Oh, God. Please don't make it. Oh, never mind.
I was folding socks. It was not my choice. And he had a family on there where the mom was a sex therapist. And she talked to her son-in-law about sex and showed her and the sorts of things that she would say. And the critical mass of her saying the word clitoris over and over and over again and making hand motions on how it's supposed to be touched and all this was it really made me.
And that's
like,
probably at 3 or 4
3
o'clock
or 4
in the
afternoon when kids would likely be watching.
Can I draw
more likely than in the morning when Howard Stern is on.
Can I draw a comparison here?
Yes,
and you're going to think I'm going somewhere with this, and I'm actually going elsewhere. But I was on a flight home from England two nights ago, and there was a very nice woman, a European woman, and she had a little baby with her. And I assured her, look, I have four kids. Don't worry. If your child is fussy, don't think I'm somebody who's going to complain at all. And she thanked me, so that was very nice. And about 10 minutes later, she started openly breastfeeding.
Awesome.
Which I had no problem with. All four of my kids have been nursed, but my wife is usually a little more discreet than this young woman chose to be. But I realized I was adopting the same pose on that airplane where I had to pretend not to notice the obvious, that the same pose that I use when I'm in the living room watching a basketball game at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and a Cialis commercial comes on, and I have to pretend in front of my 11- and 13-year-old that I do not hear the term erections lasting longer than 4 hours.
Yeah.
And
require immediate medical attention. I even know the whole line.
And to me, that's offensive. And yeah. I wonder if the Cialis, Viagra, all of those will be cracked down on.
Male enhancement industry.
Yeah, you know what? And it becomes constant repetition. Just as I said, you know what? Eventually, I will start singing along with Jenny on the Block.
Yeah.
Just because it's a subtle form of brainwashing. It comes to the point where I'm like, well, maybe something's wrong with me if this guy using the natural male enhancements got such a big smile on his face. I mean, I go into the store and I see that, and part of me is like, maybe I
need see that price tag. Amy, thanks a lot for calling. Those of you who are holding on, please stay with us. We're going to come back and talk to more of you on the telephones. 866-303-2270. Where do you draw the line on indecency? This is Air America Radio.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow. Yes. Yes. I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah. Drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay. Well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
One minute past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is back on Monday. Oh, I love this kind of music, Mick Foley.
Groovy.
Yeah, man. But it's not inappropriate, is it? I mean, you know, it's got that little organ in the background.
Little organ is
those little smoky bars and things. And well, hey, we want to find out from you where you draw the line with indecency. If you have children, what do you have your children watch? When do you say, I'm not letting him or her watch that show?
Mark, can I bring up a point here? Sure. I quoted The Wizard of Oz when I was referring to Lawton Smiles as small as a clinking, clanking collection of collisionist junk. Can I refer to The Wizard again?
Sure.
This is in reference to Senator Joe Lieberman, who was talking about our SmackDown prog a few years ago, and he said, there's only so much I watch myself. Forgive me, I'm busy. I flip the dials. I read some of the reports on content. And my feeling was, how can you look at a very subjective report on content and come to an objective conclusion? And I started looking at some of like our more popular shows, and it was like, man, if you look at it that way, The Wizard of Oz, looking at the book version, if you read the book.
Oh, yeah.
It's basically a story of witchcraft, death by house dropping, theft, quadruple limb amputation, which is why the Tin Man was a Tin Man.
Yeah.
42 decapitations, 40 neck breakings, that's when the scarecrow is breaking the bird's necks, suggested drug use with the poppy, contract killing, kidnapping, and murder by melting. And Hansel and Gretel is about child abandonment, child abuse, trespassing, destruction of property, kidnapping, imprisonment, attempted cannibalism, and murder by boiling. So if somebody wants to take issue with any show, it's like almost like interpreting the Bible.
Yeah.
You can pick and choose your spots to arrive at any desired conclusion.
I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it. Let's go back to our phones. Let's say good morning to Wynn, who is calling us from the borough of Queens, New York. Wynn, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Okay. How are you doing?
Good.
Thank you.
How do you define obscenity, Wynn, or better yet, indecency?
Well, I choose to... I rather to choose the word inappropriate than indecent.
Okay.
One of the most inappropriate show that I have ever seen for the little children is like when they show Buster Bunny visiting Vermont and then seeing two lesbian moms, you know. I don't think that's appropriate for little children.
Now, how did we know? There's been a lot of talk about this. How did we know they were lesbians? Simply because they were portrayed as being together?
Well, everybody knows they are lesbian. Not only two of them, but you know, at the end of the show, Buster Bunny was greeted by at least I think five lesbian moms. You know.
How did you know? But how do you think a child would know? Assuming that they didn't say so and so's character lesbian mom in a graphic, how would a child know that?
But this introducing little children to alternative lifestyle.
No. How would a child know that if you didn't tell them? Because obviously they didn't reference lesbian moms in the cartoon, so how would a child know? Just because the two of them were together, that was Mick's original point.
Well, they are lesbians, you know.
No. I know you may come to that conclusion as an adult,
but
most children don't know what lesbianism is.
Now you're stating they are lesbians, but how did you know they were lesbians? So as I understand it, I don't believe at any time the women portrayed were kissing or fondling or doing anything that suggested lesbian behavior.
No, it doesn't show any fondling, but everybody knows it's lesbian. And then if little children was exposed, to a lesbian lifestyle at such an early age.
Now, let me pose it this way. My 4-year-old's favorite new book is Sugarbush Spring, which is about making maple syrup in Vermont. So much so that when we visit the country's oldest general store, which is only a mile from my house, 1902, he calls it the maple syrup store because I paid $4.95 for a 2-ounce bottle of maple syrup, the only place I could find it. I'm thinking of taking him to a maple syrup farm. Now, if I took my 4-year-old to that farm and there were two women or four women or five women and I believed they were lesbians, personally, I wouldn't find that offensive and I can't understand why anybody would.
I wouldn't have a problem with it at all.
So I believe you probably have a problem with lesbians,
Per
se.
No, I do not have any problem with lesbian or gays. A lot of my friends are gays. I believe me, I do not have a problem with gays. I just do not want a little youngster exposed to alternative lifestyle.
Okay, but Wynn, now let me ask you this. How old do you think a child should be before he sees a beer commercial?
A beer commercial?
Yeah, a beer commercial.
Well, I should say... teenager, 14, 15, that should be appropriate.
So, in other words, you edit beer commercials out of your children's television watching? You never watched a football game with your kids and had a beer commercial come on?
Well, that's not really inappropriate.
That's what I was getting at. You don't think that's inappropriate. You don't think the consumption of alcohol and glamorizing the consumption of alcohol is a problem, but lesbians are a problem?
You got them on the line, Riley. Reel them in.
I'm just asking because, I want to know.
Around.
I don't agree with them, but I just don't think that you can, say I would be far more concerned with my child watching a series of beer commercials that during any athletic
event. Not to mention the enhancement commercials.
And, yeah, the enhancement commercials. Yeah, and I know those by heart. I'm starting to scare myself. Thank you very much for the phone call. When we come back, New York Giants running back Tiki Barber. We talked to him on the phone about his latest thespian activities here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley with our very special guest co-host, wrestling legend and best-selling author Mick Foley.
Good morning, Mick.
Hey, this has been, it's been a very good morning.
It's
I'm
been
sad
a great
to say,
morning.
26 more minutes and I'm out of here.
Yeah, 26 more minutes and I'm out of here and got to come back tomorrow. You can sleep.
I may break down like Lawton Smalls here. I don't want to go.
Now, I know that our listeners thought we were psyching them out when we said we were going to have our next guest on the air. We are pleased to have on the phone New York Giants running back Tiki Barber. Tiki is currently starring in the off-Broadway production of John Patrick Shanley's Women of Manhattan. He was voted the team's most valuable player in 2004, 2002, and 2000, that is. And he co-authored with his twin brother, Rondé, a children's book called By My Brother's Side. This is the first in the series, and the next in the series, Game Day, will be published this fall. Tiki Barber, good morning, and thanks for being with
Mark.
Us.
Can I brag for just a second? Tiki, yeah. you don't mind if I...
Go ahead.
Tiki's a buddy of mine.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, there you go.
I don't even know if you remember this, Mick, but we met probably in 1998.
It was New London, Connecticut.
Up in Connecticut, back when you were Mankind. Mankind.
Well, Tiki, thanks for being with us. This is your play, the work that you're acting in. Is Women of Manhattan. It runs through March 26th for our New York listeners at the Greenwich Street Theater in Manhattan. Tell us, what drew you to this role?
You know what? It's just an opportunity I had. I took some acting lessons with a teacher of mine, Peggy Lewis, about 4 years ago because this film I was going to do. The film ended up falling through, but I kept working with Peggy, and I learned a lot about the trade and about how to project myself and to convince people that I was someone else. And then she called me about 8 months ago and said she was directing this play, Women of Manhattan, and thought I'd be good for a role. And I took it. I thought it was a great opportunity, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. I tell you what, it's a challenge. It's just like any other form of entertainment. It's challenging, but it's very fulfilling.
Is this something you might want to pursue when your football days are over?
Possibly. I'm getting pretty good reviews, so I think people are convinced that I can do this a little bit. And you never know. You know, like with you, Mick, you can't wrestle forever. I can't play football forever.
Well,
and you got to find something else to do.
Well, two letters of warning, Tiki, for those ex-football running back stars pursuing the movies. OJ.
Okay. Right.
You don't wanna, that's maybe not the best.
I'm not in that LA lifestyle, though.
Well, Jim Brown. Jim Brown was a mean figure on screen.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He was pretty good, actually.
Yeah, actually, I saw him on TV the other day in a movie. I forget.
Still bad.
Yeah.
Still bad.
Now, Tiki, what is Women of Manhattan, and what role do you play in the work?
Well, it's a play about three Upper West Side yuppie-type women, and they all have different problems, and one of them in particular, Judy, who's played by Leah Blessoff, is she's kind of a put-together woman where she wears suits and she's very stern and she's never getting any, you know. So she gets set up on a blind date.
That's where you enter the picture?
Yeah, exactly. She gets set up on a blind date with my character, who is Duke. And we kind of have this tension going on. And it's a fun play. It's a fun scene, and we get a lot of laughs out of it. And I end up getting to kiss the girl at the end, so it's fun.
Oh, wow. So now, this is a limited-run role. I understand it may get extended depending on, you know...
depending on how the interest is. It, you know, it was only set to run for 10 performances for 2 weeks. And, you know, we're getting a lot of interest. A lot of people have been coming, and so we may extend it for a week. But it's an equity showcase with a couple of equity actors, and I've had a great time with it. I've learned a lot from my fellow actors, and I've enjoyed the process.
Now, did you have to get your Equity card? Did you? Are you now a card-carrying actor?
No, I'm not. Not yet. If I decide to do this full time, when Coach Coughlin decides that I can't play football anymore, then I may do that.
I think they'll have another coach before they decide you can't play football anymore.
Now, Tiki, I don't want to put you on the spot politically, because I know as an NFL player you appeal to people of all races. Absolutely. And political affiliations, but any chance of any repercussions from Strahan, who's an avowed Republican, over you talking to us on this show, which is avowedly not Republican?
Exactly. I don't know. You know, I'm one of those guys that kind of toes the line. I can be on both sides of the fence sometimes, the other side the other time. And you know, it politics is something that interests me, but more so in a media aspect of it. I've been working hard over the last few years to expand my broadcasting resume, some of it in sports, but other times I'm trying to get into different avenues of it.
Any chance that your next run may be a political one?
It could be.
That might be fun.
Politics is tough. It takes a lot of
time. Hey, can I say this about Tiki? You know, we did meet in New London. We got together at a huge party, which we may talk about here in a minute. But for the most part, I see Tiki a couple times a year at the Muscular Dystrophy Association benefits. And I'll tell you something that really stood out to me was there's an event they do called Muscle Team every year with members of the Jets, Giants, Yankees, Mets, Metro Stars, what have you. And in a lot of cases, a lot of the stars, you know, they show up and they make their appearance and they leave. Tiki Barber is a guy who, along with Al Leiter before he was traded, is a guy who really puts in the time and gets to know the kids. And I know John Abraham of the Jets
absolutely.
Is the same way and have become close to a lot of the kids. And, you know, may I say the work you do on their behalf is really appreciated and really touching.
I appreciate it. It's a great organization. I remember my first buddy over there, Stephanie Ortega. We had a pen pal relationship for a long time. And it's great the work they do. They get a lot of pub, they get a lot of money, and they raise a lot of awareness for neuromuscular disease. And it's a great event. It's fun every year. You know, Kim Hampton is always there, who's one of my favorite.
Yeah.
And it's enjoyable. It's an enjoyable evening for a good cause. And you forgot to mention yourself, Mick. You're always there too, which is phenomenal.
My heart really goes out to these kids. They always have me do the auction for the summer camp as I go out and hang out with the kids.
Exactly.
I try to make it every summer. And the saddest thing about that disease is when I go visit the younger kids, they are, for the most part, walking and doing fairly well. And then when I go visit the older kids, they're almost all completely in wheelchairs. And I remember I took my son and my daughter a couple of years ago, and they were just not prepared for the sight of 50 kids in wheelchairs without ability to move a lot of their limbs. And, like, my son was shaking. He was behind a tree.
Absolutely.
He was so upset. And to his credit, you know, he went on and, you know, adapted and has, come to these events with me. And, you know, so as a parent, I'm trying to create, you know, an appreciation and an awareness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even though this isn't why we do it, did I tell you about the hug I got?
No, you didn't.
No.
I have the microphone as I'm trying to get pledges for the camp.
Yeah.
And Dorothy Hamill was there. And I figured that time was as good as any to declare that I had a crush on her for 29 years.
I love it.
And
I
thought she'd be appalled, but she really seemed to get a kick out of it.
Well,
and
the hug must have been very fulfilling.
Man, and she gave me her email address
and asked
me to, you know, email her a picture, and that's where being computer illiterate is really a pain in the neck.
It's hurting you, right?
Oh, man, so Dorothy, if you're out there, the intention is there.
Exactly.
My wife is hopefully not listening. if my mom's listening, don't pass that on.
Yeah, right. That's great.
But it was really cool. You mind if I bring up that party just for a second?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
This party was unbelievable.
It was disheartening in a way, Mark, because I was under the impression that I had done fairly well in life until I got to this man's house. He's a great guy and a heck of a philanthropist as well, but a billionaire, apparently many times over.
Yeah.
And he had a party guest list that included Ronald McDonald, Popeye, Stone Cold.
Oh, wow.
Me. I was under the impression that Stone Cold and I were there for his kids' sake, but we weren't. He was the wrestler.
Was the wrestler. Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
And one of his kids came up, the youngest one, he tugs on his sleeve, says, Daddy, you go downstairs and play football with me.
Yeah.
And he had almost like a full-size football field
in his house?
I mean, it was big. It was about 40 yards long. And we went downstairs, and there's Tiki
and Curtis Martin of the Jets, you know, two of the finest running backs in the NFL, and they're signing pictures and footballs. And after that was done, we went upstairs, the lights were out, and all of a sudden the lights come on, and in the living room, the OJs were playing.
Oh, wow.
Not a CD, not a record. I mean, the real OJs.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Exactly.
That was a phenomenal event. You know, that guy, Paul Tudor Jones, he's a UVA grad, as am I, and so I have a great touch and appreciation for what he does. He's a big donor to the Robin Hood Foundation, which is a big charity to charities. And so it was amazing to see the stuff that he can do with the money that he's made in his lifetime. And that was an amazing event. I tell you, the fireworks are what got me in the end. We go out on the balcony on the back of his porch, and it's a huge backyard, and all of a sudden fireworks start shooting. It's like the 4th of July back there.
I know. I felt like such a loser on the way home, though.
Curtis Martin leans over to me and goes, "This guy's for real." I give a lot of credit to him because Paul is very philanthropic and gives a lot of money. He makes a lot of money, obviously, in the hedge fund business, but he gives a lot of it back, which is important.
Incredible. Tiki Barber is our guest, New York Giants running back, and starring in the off-Broadway production of John Patrick Shanley's Women of Manhattan. We're going to take a quick break, come back, talk some more with Tiki Barber, and then Mick Foley, you got one last thing you got to do.
And that would be?
We'll tell you when we get back here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition,
the highest-rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
In the words of the immortal Mark Maron, let's land this bad boy. It's 48 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Mick Foley is our special guest co-host, and we are pleased to have on our telephone lines New York Giants running back Tiki Barber, who is currently starring in the off-Broadway production of John Patrick Shanley's Women of Manhattan that runs through this coming Saturday, March 26th, here in New York City at the Greenwich Street Theater.
And Tiki, by the way, was the NFL's, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you were the NFL's leading rusher last year.
No, Curtis actually.
Oh, Curtis.
Was the all-purpose leader.
That is embarrassing. All-purpose leader.
Hey, man, New York had two of the best last year.
Yeah, you got that right.
No, we were talking during the break about your pretty exhaustive training regimen and how you credit that with a lot of the success of the past few years.
Absolutely. I mean, I took a different philosophy a couple of years ago, and I started working out with a power lifter because, as you can attest to, once you start getting older, your muscles start breaking down, your bones and ligaments. And
I never had any of those muscles to begin with, so my ligaments and bones are in rough shape.
Exactly. But this guy out in New Jersey, his name's Joe Carini. He was a former New Jersey Strongest Man, six times, actually. Has reformed my body and made me strong and explosive at the age of 30, when a lot of people say running backs in particular start to lose this stuff. And I gotta hand it to this kind of training. It's kept me young, and it's allowed me to play at a high level when most people think you're past your peak. And so I'm excited. I'm actually out here with my brother. He's training right now with Will. He had knee surgery this offseason. He's trying to get strong and healthy and extend his career as well.
Now, when we speak of strength and explosive power, steroids are in the news.
Absolutely.
And right now it's baseball being busted on. What is the NFL's steroid policy, and how do they police the players?
Well, we're very strict with our policies. You know, and it's an interesting and it's kind of a weird policy in effect, because substances of abuse we get tested for once, cocaine, marijuana, et cetera. But steroids and performance-enhancing drugs, we're tested on a random basis. So you literally could get tested 16 times out of the year, or you could get tested once or twice, and so you never know. But I think that the biggest crux of our policy and what makes it so effective is that it's basically no tolerance. You get caught once, you're suspended 4 games. You get caught twice, you're suspended for the year. And so there's an enormous deterrent, and this is suspended without pay. There's an enormous deterrent for us not to get caught doing those type of things. I think the other leagues, you know, kind of want to be like that, but they're afraid to offend the unions and things like that. And it's made for a touchy situation, and it's made for bad influence on their sport.
You know, I think baseball's in a tougher spot, because assuming that football is completely cleaned up and the players across the board, if the playing field is level, are uniformly a little bit, just a touch slower, a little bit weaker, you're not going to see that on the field.
No. Yeah.
You're not going to see the difference. Whereas in baseball, if those home runs start dropping 20 feet from the fence, everyone's going to say,
Well, I think in football, it's I think it's a little bit easier because it's such a team game where you have to rely on the center to snap it to the quarterback to pass it down the field. You know, everything relies on everything else. Whereas in baseball, one guy can hit three home runs in a game and you win the game. And so it gets exacerbated when all of a sudden that guy is not hitting home runs anymore because he's not as strong or because he's done something to get himself that or take himself away from that advantage.
Now, Tiki, how do the players view the whole notion of being able to mask steroid use? That seems to be the big issue in baseball, certainly in terms of the Balco case, where it appears that people could use the steroids and the tests would not show it. What do the players think about that?
Well, you know, it's a weird situation, and I think what happens is you guys remember when creatine first came out?
Yes, sure.
When I was in college, I was on creatine for about 3 or 4 months, and I got off of it because I started pulling muscles. But I think athletes are always looking for an advantage. They're always looking for a way to make themselves better than that next guy because, you know what, it's money. You know, this is your livelihood, and if you want to make more money than this guy or even just stay in the game, you got to be a little bit better. And so they look for that little bit of an edge. And unfortunately, I think outside influences, you know, other than the players themselves, you know, just some guy coming up to them and says, well, you know what, I can get you that edge. They jump at it, and they said, well, you're going to get caught with it. And they say, you know what, I can mask it. And so they have this air of, you know, I'm not going to get caught, and it's going to give me an advantage, and I'm going to be a star because I'm taking this drug. But what they don't see in the long run is two things. One, they're destroying their bodies. I think it's a known fact that steroid use destroys the workings of your body, and you end up prematurely deteriorating as a person. And two, when you do get caught and you're put on a stage, you're sending such a bad message to kids because they say, oh, okay, my hero was trying this, maybe I should try it. And that's what bothers me the most, is that you have these 12, 14-year-old kids looking for an advantage in sports. They do what their heroes do, which is try a drug. And it leads down the road to destruction.
Tiki, did you ever see the ESPN series Playmakers?
Yeah, I did.
And what did you think of it?
I thought it was, you know, if that show was on HBO, I would have loved it.
Right.
But the fact that it was on ESPN, which most people view as a news channel, disturbed me a little bit because all of a sudden, the 12-year-old kid thinks this is how all athletes are. I mean, there was no redeeming qualities about any of these players. None of them went to charity events. None of them.
Well, you know, there was one running back who's pretty much the antithesis of everything you are, who grudgingly went to visit a kid in the hospital because his contract called for it. And while he was there, he snagged the kid's pain medicine.
Exactly. You know, that's maybe 1%. I mean, sports is a dichotomy of this country. That, you know, there's bad apples everywhere. And maybe 1% of the guys in the NFL are like that. Probably less than that. Most of us are good guys. They willingly go and help people in need. They go see kids in hospitals. And that was not portrayed. And so I think the good guys of us got a bad rap because of this show.
But now,
all anyone talked about was, oh, this guy beats his wife. This guy, you know, cheats on his wife. This guy steals money. I mean, it was.
I know that show was awesome.
It was, like I said, if it was on HBO and you knew that it was like that, it was just like The Sopranos and it was on HBO. It would have been a great show, and it would have lasted forever.
That running back snagging the pain medicine always reminded me of Rush Limbaugh going to visit a young conservative radio fan and swiping the meds.
Swiping the meds. Tiki Barber, it was really great having you with us. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you guys. You guys take care. See you, Mick. I'll see you in a couple months.
Sounds great. Thanks, Tiki.
All right. Tiki Barber, and again, he is starring in the off-Broadway production of John Patrick Shanley's Women of Manhattan, playing right here in New York City.
Oh, that Giants locker room is going to bust on him.
Yeah, I know. Hey, Tiki, come on, act over here.
No, I think it's great. Like you said, why not expand and look at life past wrestling? What a great statesman he is, spokesman for the sport. I wish everybody could be like him.
Oh, yeah. You know, I always wondered whether he and his, because, his brother Rondé's a twin.
Yeah.
I always wondered if they, changed classes and stuff when they were younger, because I'm sure they came up together. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to the same
school. Hold on. I don't mean to cut off Tiki Barber, but I believe that's my fax machine.
Yeah.
Hot off the machine. Now it's time for the liberal agenda. I get to do this too, Riley.
Yeah, go ahead.
Pilot, liberal agenda, all in the same day. And here's the facts from the Streisand compound. Remember, liberal soldiers, these are your marching orders for the day. Write these down. Number one, just to see what he'll do, call Brent Fozell and complain about the shocking sex and violence on C-SPAN. Very good. Number two, organize the first annual Liberal Wrestler Appreciation Day.
Yeah!
Be a lonely event. Number three, develop new professional wrestling character, the Doomocrat. Slogan, here's my new deal, pain. Four, start referring to the 2006 elections as the SmackDown.
There you go.
And number five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation, keep your hands off my Social Security. I'm warning you. One more step and you're entering a world of pain, sheeple. That does it. Rah! Keep your hands off the Social Security money.
Mick Foley's been great having you. We got to have you back again the next time Marin takes vacation. We really appreciate it.
I hope it's soon.
All right.
I can arrange for a permanent vacation for Mr. Marin.
Join us tomorrow.
I know some people.
Laura Flanders is with us along with Congressman Jerry Nadler, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on